can.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. You know, Israel benefited from this as well in, you know, kind of coalescing and like, okay, here are our allies. There's been a lot of like friction and a lot of pressures, but like when it comes down to it, these interests do not want to see wider war. You know, Biden does not want to see wider war. What that would mean for oil prices and for his reelection chances is much a factor as his allyship with Israel. And it was a live military exercise where they could test out their defenses. And, you know, it seems like it held up fairly well. All of this is like once the fog of war kind of settled a little bit, we could kind of get a little bit of insight. And it seems like that's solid analysis, you know, that we're piecing together from these different sources. But as it was happening, all bets were off. And it really did scare the living shit out of me. The idea that like in the absence of good information, all you need is a bad piece of information to kind of slip into strategic decision making. And if it becomes accepted intelligence or if the perception itself becomes reality that perhaps the damages were greater or the casualties were greater, which gives, I don't know the dynamics of, certainly there's like tensions in Netanyahu's desire for a wider war and other pressures holding him back. Sometimes it's just about, okay, well, enough people think that I have cause to retaliate because of some AI. It just seems like we're really like right at the brink, like teetering over and just like we were one meme away from, I don't know, completely uncharted territory.
Yeah, and I mean, this was always kind of during the Cold War, the Doctor Strangelove scenario, that you'd have a series of misperceptions, you know, leading to that ultimate escalation. And it's particularly dangerous when you have Israel, it hasn't acknowledged it, but it is a nuclear-armed state. Iran probably fairly close to being a nuclear-armed state, so I think these sorts of skirmishes and these sorts of unclear signals are only going to get more dangerous, I think, as we see the sorts of weapons involved and the sorts of resources at each country's disposal, each party's disposal proliferate.
It also made me wonder, like, huh, has the news crisis hit Israel? Because, like, the need for news, if you live in Israel, where, like, people are used to air raid sirens going off and have, like, you need to know when to go into a bomb shelter. And I did a little bit of clicking around. I'm like, it seems like the news media is pretty effective and the news business is like pretty healthy in Israel. And it made me wonder about like what happens in a society where news is not sort of like, I want to keep informed about the world, but like you need to know what is going on because whether or not your country still exists is up in the air. You must follow along for political reasons, for practical reasons. It's a different sales pitch to the population there.
The stereotype about Israel is that there's always been this sort of hyper-informed population that's borderline obsessed with the news. I'm sure you've heard the joke, you know, if you want three opinions, ask two Israelis. I mean, you have a very vibrant domestic political scene as well. So I think that's not only out of necessity, but it's also a culture and I think a positive one that's developed within Israel. And I think that's part of why you have such a robust media environment that by the way, includes actors like Al Jazeera, which is essentially, I think, pushing a narrative within Israel.
I mean, the Israeli government has come down and you know, was talking about kicking Al Jazeera out and has even talked about, you know, sanctions to some members of government against Haaretz. So, you know, you do have a free press in Israel, but certainly there's authoritative tendencies with this government. But, you know, my feeling, I mean, nothing you said is incorrect about Al Jazeera. It is a news organ that is funded by Qatar. And I know from people who work there that, like, they have general freedom to report as they will, but there are red lines. There are guardrails for what you can report and whatnot. And yes, they have their sympathies and their bent. And, you know, the motives of funding this have to be looked at as well. All that being said, they've had some of the most terrific on-the-ground coverage. Terrific is the wrong, like, people are dying to get us this coverage. But you're seeing things through Al Jazeera that you are not seeing anywhere else. And that, too, is part of this robust picture of, like, what a functional media in a place where they actually really, really need one. It'd be nice if you didn't have to have circumstances like, you know, kind of a permanent protracted occupation and war to generate a robust media. But, you know, there you go.
The Arab version is quite a bit different in tone and in viewpoint than the English version.
Raheem, it is your first time on Shortcuts. You have a sacred duty to duly note something in the news that people might not have heard about and they need to. What do you got?
Canada is a hockey-obsessed nation, and I get that, but I think sometimes it overshadows our excellence in other sports. And I think all of Canada should be talking right now about the Oklahoma City Thunder, led by Toronto's own Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, becoming the youngest team, median age-wise in NBA history, to secure a first seed. So they're the number one seed now in the West. The median age of the roster is 23.9 years old, led by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, age 25. And I think if there's any justice in the world, he'll be the MVP. Personally, he and I both have a connection to Lexington, Kentucky. He spent a year there in his college ball. I spent 3 years there teaching. Met my beautiful wife in Lexington, Kentucky. So we both have the Canada to Kentucky connection. And I just think we should be seeing a lot more about Mr. Gilgeous-Alexander across Canadian media.
I mean, this is where I normally say duly noted, but if I'm being honest here, my brain just went to the place it always goes when men talk about sports or anyone talks about sports. That's when I do my deep thinking, my reflection. I am so efficient because people talk about sports and I just check out. But I'm an anomaly and our listeners appreciated that. So on their behalf, duly noted. I have one to share. Raheem.
Yes.
I want to duly note that, I don't know, man, I might be getting overly sensitive about this anti-Semitism stuff. Like, I don't know, maybe I'm, like, seeing racism against Jews where there is none. Like, what am I doing getting upset about, like, a beef between two rappers? The story here, rapper Rick Ross took a shot at Drake, who happens to be both black and Jewish. Maybe I jumped the gun. Maybe the fact that Drake is a Jew had nothing to do with this. I mean, it's not like Rick Ross was out there going like, hey, big nose. Hey, you pastrami-eating, big nose, white guy. Like, oh, wait, he was exactly saying that.
The pastrami posse, BBL Drizzy, called his mommy on me. He shared their text messages between each other. Cupcake Drake, tell your mama you stayed out past your curfew, white boy. But anyway, big nose. Big nose.
Raheem, that was very, very racist. I want to acknowledge before I get further into this that, like, a pastrami posse sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I used to roll with a bunch of Jews, and we would go very far for good deli.
Yeah, on rye, man. I'm there with some Russian dressing. I am absolutely there.
If it had occurred to me to call us a pastrami posse, I would have claimed that. We would all have T-shirts that say pastrami posse. But that is not a joke that Rick Ross is allowed to make, right? Like, there are rules. Like, you can't be like, oh, you big nose, pickle-eating pastrami. No, it's f***ing Rick, man. There's a lot going on in this war between Rick Ross and Drake and also Kendrick. It was racist in a bunch of different ways. It was confusing racism because Rick Ross was like, actually, the nose comment was with reference to this alleged nose job Drake got. But if you're talking to a Jewish guy and calling him a big nose, that carries. But then he's like saying like he's running away from blackness with his alleged nose job, but he's also accusing him of trying to be like extra black by hanging with black guys. It's very offensive to mixed black people. It was directly and super offensive to Jews. And it was interesting to me in the coverage of this, everyone's afraid now to say what this obviously was, which is like Rick Ross was being an anti-Semite. They don't like to use the word. So there's like all this coverage in the rap press of like the racial overtones of the pastrami posse comment. Like it actually seems like it's more taboo to call anti-Semitism anti-Semitism than it is to be anti-Semitic, you know? So I don't know, maybe I'm getting oversensitive, but not in this case, because Rick Ross was totally on some anti-Jew shit. Yeah, I'm sure that Rick Ross will be informed of my diss by the end of the day, and will probably retaliate in a vicious rhyming form. But I will say this, I guess I'm on side Drake here. When it comes to my Lanceman Drake, Rick Ross, get my wife's name out your motherfucking mouth.
Duly noted.
Raheem, do you watch Bill Maher?
You know, I haven't thought about Bill Maher in quite some time. He hasn't really been culturally relevant since maybe George W. Bush. It's funny because it looks like he never ages.
That's just because he always looked old.
That's the thing. It's like Steve Martin. Steve Martin is always 40. He looked 40 when he was 20. He looks 40 now that he's like 65 or 70. Some people are just like that.
Yeah, but Steve Martin always looks good.
Yeah. Silver Fox.
I don't want to shit too much on Bill Maher. Politically Incorrect was the only thing of its kind when it was on network TV late night. I would stay up late to watch it. And yeah, he's lost relevance for me, but he's hanging on. He's still on HBO. And now he's in Canadian news because we pay attention to them when they take a second to pay attention to us. And he spent a good portion of a recent show on HBO roasting Canada.
The unemployment rate in the U.S. is 3.8%. And in Canada, it's 6.1%. And of the 15 North American cities with the worst air pollution, 14 are in Canada. I'm not citing these stats because I have it out for Canada. I love Canada, but I hate zombie lies. That's when things change, but what people say about them doesn't. Canada was where all the treasured goals of liberalism worked perfectly. It was like NPR come to life. But with Putin. There's only one problem with thinking everything's better in Canada. It's not. Not anymore, anyway. The median price of a home here is 346 grand. In Canada, converted to U.S. dollars, it's 487. If Barbie moved to Winnipeg, she wouldn't be able to afford her dream house, and Ken would be working at Tim Hortons. And again, honestly, Canada, I'm not saying any of this because I enjoy it. I don't, because I've always enjoyed you. But I need to cite you as a cautionary tale to help my country. At its worst, Canada is what American voters think happens when there's no one putting a check on extreme wokeness.
What'd you think?
So a few kind of gut reactions there. The first two things that he mentioned, nothing to do with wokeness. So Canada's always had a somewhat higher natural rate of unemployment because we have things like strong labor unions, minimum wage laws, more seasonal work, all of which, you know, sometimes makes it harder for people in Canada to find a job. Canada having, you know, worse air quality because of the forest fires. I thought it was interesting that, you know, he came out of the gate with two statistics that probably would have been the same 5 years ago. And I don't see really where wokeness comes into play.
Yeah, I think that this kind of crusade against zombie lies would be a stronger argument if there wasn't so much lying in the bit. But, you know, my primary complaint about this is that he's stealing my material. Canada is not the progressive paradise you think it is. It's a f***ed up country. We wrote a book about that. That was the Canada Land Guide to Canada, and we're not credited there. So I'll try not to take this too personally. But, like, there's some good stuff mixed in with just some bullshit. It hurts that he's doing the exact same thing, which is that he's weaponizing a fake idea about Canada to score some rhetorical points, and he doesn't really care if it's true or not, which is exactly what he's accusing the left of doing. You bring up a couple good ones, like the unemployment. There's more to that unemployment stat than it's certainly got nothing to do with wokeness. He doesn't even mention the wildfires when he talks about how we've got, you know, more polluted cities in Canada than they have in the States. Pretty relevant fact. We have a lot of woods up here. So I don't know if that has anything to do with wokeness. The substance came in, like, the housing stuff. But even there, it's like, if you're going to slam us on housing affordability, which is, like, definitely a vulnerability here and a very effective and true criticism of Canada, why are you going for Winnipeg? That's like the last place where you actually can, you know, Ken and Barbie could get their dream house in Winnipeg.
Yeah, and I would say, interestingly enough, I got paid by my employer to go and check out Tucker Carlson when he was in Edmonton in January. I believe it was called the Sworn Enemy Tour. So 10, 15 years ago, I would have put Tucker Carlson and Bill Maher on opposite ends of the political spectrum, but they're saying a lot of things that are similar in terms of the sort of straw man of Canada that they take, you know, and they beat up as an example of wokeness run amok. So I think it's interesting now that you're seeing, I would say, a disgruntled progressive like Bill Maher find common cause with, I don't know what you'd call Tucker Carlson, a populist conservative, an alt-right figure, but it's interesting that you're beginning to see these two worlds sort of start to collide, and you're seeing a lot of the same rhetoric targeting Canada from two individuals that I think until recently you would have said, okay, one is on the right, the other's on the left.
I wish I could just say who the f*** cares what Bill Maher says about Canada, but much in the same way that it was never simply about progressive Americans using Canada as a rhetorical tool, you know, based on kind of low information cliches about Canada to say this is what we could have here in America if only we X, Y, and Z. And they didn't really care if it was true or not, right? And it's the exact same thing if Americans on the other side, and Bill Maher is increasingly, I think, representing the other side, want to say, actually, Canada is a woke dystopia. This is what happens when wokeness goes too far, and they don't really care if it's true or not, and they're just weaponizing it. You could conclude, like, I don't really care. What does that have to do with us and our politics if they want to do that? It's a bit annoying when somebody kind of gets you wrong, but it doesn't really matter either. But the thing is, it does matter because we really pay so much attention to what Americans think of us. And it was, you know, Canadians on the left really liked the fact that Americans thought we were a utopia and would cite us in that way. And now Canadians on the right are sharing Bill Maher and latching onto this idea of like, look, Trudeau has made this a woke hellhole. Even Bill Maher is taking notice now. And so we're actually kind of like their propaganda for them about us becomes our propaganda about us. And we're replacing one set of zombie lies with another one. And now this is just the living example of wokeness gone way too far. Is becoming more like I think it's fighting for equal or greater space with like you don't hear a lot of people citing Canada as that kind of progressive utopia anymore. What a hacky joke! Like if like NPR as a country, but with Putin, like come on, he could do better than that. We did better than that. The Canada Land Guide to Canada.
Yeah, that's cringe. That's hella cringe.
Yeah, he got a good laugh for it, though. Like just I think just saying poutine gets a laugh. Like, that's a funny word, especially when you mispronounce it. If he said poutine, I don't think it would get the same laugh.
Yeah. I mean, are you talking about the Russian dictator or the food item?
See, that's a better joke. Raheem, that's Shortcuts. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Jesse.
I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that people send in. Raheem Mohammed, where can people find you?
You can find me on X. I am a problem tweeter, rmohammed_yyc. I'm currently in a flame war with Bruce Arthur of the Toronto Star over whether Canada has a better basketball starting five or the United States. I was kind of multitasking between that and this interview, but my Twitter feed is a very lively place, so you will not regret following me.
I was excited about a flame war between you and Bruce Arthur until I learned that it was about sport. Quick reminder that we have our first ever audio contest. Submissions are open. Go check it out right now at canadaland.com/audio contest. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Proulx. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
you still judge me so harshly every time I misspeak.